My guest is film director, writer, and actor John Sayles. He's one of the few young filmmakers who has managed to make small, personal films that have turned profits at the box office. His early movies, like Return of the Secaucus 7, about a reunion of old college friends, and Liana, about a woman involved in her first lesbian relationship, were both made very cheaply. Consequently, the focus was on dialogue and ensemble acting, not on action scenes, exotic locations, or period authenticity, which would have broken the budget. Those films, as well as his movies Baby, It's You and The Brother from Another Planet, established his track record. Now he's able to shoot more technically ambitious movies. His latest film, Matewan, is based on the bloody battle to unionize the coal miners in Matewan, West Virginia. It's set in 1920 and was shot on location in West Virginia. Sayles wrote the screenplay 8 years ago. He's now completing a new movie called Eight Men Out, based on the Black Sox scandal of 1919, when members of the Chicago White Sox conspired with East Coast gamblers to throw the World Series. That's from a screenplay he wrote 11 years ago. It stars Charlie Sheen, D.B. Sweeney, and John Cusack. I spoke with John Sayles earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him why he's now going back to screenplays he wrote early in his career.
I think it's more catching up than going back. They were both screenplays that I wrote when I was just starting in the movie business about 10 years ago, in the case of Eight Men Out, about 8 years ago, in the case of Matewan. And they were things that I wrote almost just for myself, saying, this is a movie I'd like to make someday. And I had no track record as a director when I wrote Eight Men Out, and I hadn't even done Secaucus 7 yet, although I'd written it when I wrote Matewan. So that it was unlikely anybody was going to knock on my door and say, I hear you're working on a very expensive period piece. We'd like to give you the money to direct it. So it's taken a while, and some of what I've done and the rest of the work that I've done has been to build up to the point where we could raise the money to make these two.
You've probably learned a lot since you wrote those screenplays 8 and 10 years ago. Are there scenes that you had to rewrite now that you know what it takes to actually shoot a scene? Scenes that seemed easy on paper, but now that you've actually been directing for a number of years, you realize that they were too difficult, too expensive, or maybe impossible?
Yeah, I'd say often there are scenes that have to do with large, you know, either large crowds or large physical objects. In Matewan, I had some scenes at the beginning of the movie that used a coal tipple and a coal camp. And we just didn't find enough of that stuff standing in West Virginia, and we didn't have the money to build it. So the camera's a lot closer to action at the beginning of Matewan than originally it was in the screenplay. With Eight Men Out, which is the story of the Black Sox scandal of 1919, radio hadn't really evolved past the crystal set stage in those days. And so the way that people kept tabs on the World Series, because there was an incredible popular interest in it, was they'd go to their local newspaper, and outside the local newspaper there would be a huge mock-up of a baseball diamond, and somebody would be moving figures from base to base as they got the news of what was happening in the park through ticker tape. And in Times Square, as a matter of fact, up where there's a kind of moving billboard now, they had men up on scaffolds with, you know, 15-foot-long poles moving big figures around, and it was as crowded as New Year's Eve. And that shot, needless to say, I couldn't afford to shoot.
So what do? You rewrite it?
Yeah, you rewrite it. You find another way to tell that same part of the story. You know, I can pretty much break my screenplays down and say, this scene tells you this, this scene is for this moment, this scene is supposed to touch this nerve, this emotion. And if you look at the screenplay and say, I still need to touch that nerve, I still need to tell this story, you find another way to do it.
Matewan, the story of Matewan and of the miners' strike there is obviously a very important story to you. It's a screenplay you wrote about 8 years ago, and mm-hmm. It's something you've been interested in producing all of those years. Now, you grew up in Schenectady, far away from right. any mining towns. How do you identify with the story?
Well, I think the basic parts of the story that interested me, besides just the historical fact that it's an incredible story and very few people know the history, is that it's about union with a small U as well as a capital U. How do people get together? How do they form alliances? How do they overcome the things racism, ethnic separation, whatever, that keep them apart and keep them from cooperating with each other for something that they both want. And that happens everywhere. The story of Meitwan just seems that it's the epitome of a lot of things. And it was set at a real turning point in American history. The ideals that America was founded on have been tested many times, and 1920 was one of the times when they were tested all over the country.
Both Meitwan and your forthcoming film, Eight Men Out, about the Chicago team throwing the 1919 World Series, they're both period films.
Mm-hmm.
And period films are a lot more expensive to shoot, aren't they, than films set in the present?
Yeah, you basically have to, every time you turn the camera on, make sure that everything in front of it looks like it could be from that period. You have to make the people look like they're from that period, whether it's, you know, doing something with their hair or changing their clothes or whatever. So you have a conversation almost every morning during pre-production of, well, how are you going to shoot this, and are we going to see their feet? Because, you know, the costume person has to know whether to order up 400 pairs of shoes or that are period shoes or not.
Now, you shot Meitwan in the town of Thurman, West Virginia, and mm-hmm. I understand you did that because Meitwan no longer looked like a coal mining town at the turn
of
the century.
Yeah, it still, you know, looks like a small West Virginia town, but, you know, it has modern buildings and, you know, street lights and all these kind of things that really we would have had to take down, whereas Thurman really didn't have any of that stuff up. So we, you know, we were able to just kind of cover a few things up and refurbish a few things, and there we were.
I know there, in the past few years, some places have resisted filmmakers coming into their neighborhood and turning the town upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run into anything like that with Meitwan?
Not really too much. Thurman's a very small town, so you really could talk personally to almost all of the 60 or 70 inhabitants.
That's a really small population.
That's a very small population, and a lot of them don't even live right down in town. You know, there were a few people who were upset when we put a lot of dirt over what little sidewalk they had there, and then it rained. But that only lasted like a day. And, you know, we're very careful to, you know, provide other ways around things and clean things up as soon as we're done with them and all that kind of thing. But really, I think it was kind of, we were the entertainment in town for a while. You know, the train still comes through Thurman, but not much else stops there. There's whitewater rafting across the, you know, the river. But I think it was fun for people to just kind of come on down and see what we were building or what we were shooting, and we really made an attempt to make sure that there was always a place for people to sit and watch.
Film director John Sayles is my guest, and right now we're talking about his current movie, Meitwan. When you're shooting a film that's set in the past, for instance, in Meitwan, you have a lot of browns and dark colors. The lighting, I think, is different than it might have been if it was set in the present. How did mm-hmm. you try to evoke the past through the lighting and through the kinds of, through the palette that you used for the film?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's a very kind of subjective thing. For one thing, the pictures that we have from that period are all in black and white. So in the kind of imaginative memories of people who weren't there, that history is in black and white. And so that kind of bright, clean, Disney-like color seems more of a movie thing than a realistic thing. And since we were going for something much more naturalistic, we decided to desaturate the color a little bit. Another decision that we made is very often the past is seen, you know, through a glass dimly. It's kind of filtered. And it's a little bit gauzy, or they put some diffusion on the lens or pre-fog the film. If you think of McCabe and Mrs. Miller or The Godfather or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and that can give you a very kind of rich look that has the edge off of it. It doesn't make it look like the 6 o'clock news. And so it feels like it may have happened in the past before the 6 o'clock news existed. Sometimes, however, that gauziness, and I think particularly in the case of you know, when it's overdone, can make things less real and way less. It can get a bit like a you know, post card or something like that. And so we decided to, rather than having the diffusion be mechanically put on the lens or done to the film, that we would desaturate things by controlling what colors went on the screen, rather than putting a lot of diffusion filters in front of the lens. So things are fairly sharp, and that helps them keep their weight. And, you know, in a story about coal mining, we wanted things to have weight. We wanted things to, you know, seem to be heavy and solid.
Was there someone whose job it was to smear coal dust on all the coal miners?
Yeah, I mean, there's, things kind of go down the pecking order a little bit. Haskell Wexler and Nora Chavusian. Haskell was the cinematographer and Nora was the production designer, and they kind of decided what would look like what. Then Cindy Flint was the costume designer, and then the people who worked under her would go with these Hudson sprayers, which are like giant flick guns, and load up a mixture of coal and water and spray everybody down when they were coming into or out of the mine. You know, and if they were coming into the mine, they just spray their clothes, because generally you used your clothes for about a week before you got to wash them. And if they were coming out, they'd spray their whole bodies, and then we had a assistant hair person who had been a coal miner, and he basically taught all the extras who hadn't, you know, some of them had been coal miners and some of them hadn't, basically how you get coal schmutz on your face, which is that you scratch your nose and you scratch your ear and everything. So he just put some coal stuff on their hands and let them go to it.
For the movie you're working on now, 8 Men Out, you had to find a ballpark that you could use and dress it to look like it was a ballpark in 1919. Mm-hmm. What were the changes you had to make? Which ballpark did you use, first of all? And what kind of changes did you have to make to it?
Well, we ended up using Busch Stadium in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Is that an old stadium?
Yeah, it's a fairly old stadium. I'd say it was built in the 30s. So it doesn't have a huge electronic scoreboard or AstroTurf or any of those things. What we did have to do was put wood-paneled contact paper on all the seats, which were plastic. We had to take down most of the big lighting fixtures. We had to avoid shooting in certain directions because there was, you know, Indianapolis doesn't have an enormous skyline, but it does have some skyline, and it doesn't look like 1919 anymore. And basically, to make it look like two different ballparks, we put up different billboards in the outfield. One of the advantages of that period was that there were fairly high outfield walls, and that they had a lot of advertising on them, so you can give the outfields a very different look. We changed the color of the dirt from one park to the other. We changed the color of the, you know, the walls behind the home plate. You know, we changed the pillars. We put false pillars up. Comiskey Park in Chicago has these beautiful arches, and we built fake arches to stick in the, you know, in the back of the stadium. So it's a pretty massive job. I mean, it's really one of the biggest things that I've ever been involved in, and certainly Nora Chavusian and Dan Bishop, who basically designed and made sure the whole thing didn't blow down. It's the biggest thing they've been involved in.
This would have to be a cast of thousands movie just to fill the ballpark.
Yeah, getting the thousands was very difficult. But what you do, and I think they've done on almost all baseball movies, is that you have to be very, very specific about where are we going to point, how long or wide is the lens going to be, and are we going to move the camera, because you're never going to be able to shoot for 3 weeks and have 12 to 15,000 people every day. Some days you're lucky to get 400 or 200. And so we had to, before we started shooting, know, number one, how did the sun move around the ballpark? Because you don't want somebody pitching a ball in bright sunlight, and then by the time you get to the shot of the batter hitting it, have everything being shade. So you have to know where the sun is moving, and then you have to move whatever number of fans you have that day around the ballpark to keep them, you know, behind the players. And so you start them over in the right field side, in the case of this ballpark, because of where the sun came down. And by noon, they're kind of behind the plate. And in the early afternoon, they're over on the left field side. And you just keep shooting around the park that way.
Well, I guess one nice thing about directing thousands of extras in a baseball park, as everybody knows how you're supposed to behave in a baseball park.
Yeah, pretty much they are. You know, they know to follow the ball with their eyes, and you don't have to worry about, okay, are they looking at the camera? Because, you know, unless you get really close up, you know, they're not totally in focus. And then when you get really close up, you just kind of have somebody go out in the field and throw the ball around and have them follow the play with their eyes.
Were the actors really playing, by the way? Did you have a lot of extras on the field?
There's no stunt stuff on screen. You know, there's no stunt doubles or anything like that. So the actors really did play. And, you know, it's you find out fairly early who can do what. And we were very lucky because some of the guys who have major parts, Charlie Sheen, D.B. Sweeney, John Cusack, David Strathairn, are really good ball players. And that's always nice. And what I told them at the beginning is not to get too uptight when they made an error or something like that, because unlike the major leagues, they get to do a second take.
Right.
You know, and they only have to do it, you know, and have it look like a major league throw or hit or catch once, whereas, you know, if you're a major leaguer, you have to do it, you know, 9 times out of 10.
Well, this is an advantage we'd all like to have in real life.
Oh, definitely. Instant replay.
My guest is film director and actor John Sayles, and his movies include Return of the Secaucus 7, Liana, Baby It's You, Brother from Another Planet, Mate One, his current movie, and Eight Men Out, his forthcoming movie, which is about the Chicago Black Sox scandal of 1919. He's also the author of a new book called Thinking in Pictures, The Making of the Movie Mate One. We'll talk more about movies after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Film director John Sayles is my guest. When you're about to begin a movie, do you have every shot already mapped out on paper? Do you know exactly what you're doing each step of the way?
Not exactly what you're doing. You have to have an idea because you have to tell other people who are working with you what to expect. So in the case of a production designer or art director, if you're going to be shooting in a certain hollow and all the buildings have to look like they're 1920, you have to know what directions you're shooting in. Are you shooting 360? Are you shooting 180? Are you shooting only up against this one specific wall so they don't go art directing everything in sight to make it look like 1920 when, in fact, you can save all their time and money by saying, we're only going to shoot against this wall. We're going to be using a, you know, 50-millimeter lens, and give us about 20 feet on each side leeway in case we want to move the camera slightly. Sometimes when it's very expensive, yes, you have to go in and plan everything. Other times when, let's say you're up in the hills, you don't, you know, because a tree is a tree, and pretty much the trees look the same in 1920 as they looked, you know, in 1986 when we shot the movie. In fact, some of them are the same trees. Whenever you're shooting outside, you have to pick certain things to shoot first in the day and certain things to shoot at noon and certain things to shoot later in the day just because of the way the sun moves. In Eight Men Out, the nice thing is that I knew that even before we found the set, I knew certain things were true, which is that it's always 90 feet from home plate to first base. And, you know, no matter where we found the ballpark, the dimensions of the field were going to be similar. So I could do a certain amount of blocking even before we found the actual location.
Throughout your career, you've made movies that have been pretty low budget. Even your expensive movies, like Mate One, are low budget by comparison to the films everybody else is making. You really bring things in at a very modest price. I think for a lot of film directors, one of the tricks of doing that is to not work with a union crew. And I'm curious with the movie Mate One, which is about unions, if you used a union crew for that.
Yeah, actually, we used several unions. It just turned out that we worked with both IA and NABIT, which are the two big craft unions. And it was a Screen Actors Guild union, and it was a Writers Guild union, and I'm not in the Directors Guild, so it wasn't a Directors Guild picture. But yeah, we made a special effort to have Mate One be a union picture, and it cost us some extra money. But, you know, there's always trade-offs. There's people who are in those guilds and unions who are very good, who you like to work with. And, you know, I've made non-union pictures as well. Usually what's happened in the past before Mate One is that they've actually been mixed, which is that some of the members of the crew are in a union and some aren't. And you basically pay them the same amount, except the people who aren't in the union don't get the same benefits.
When you make a movie that's non-union, does it make you feel like a hypocrite, or do you feel that there are really strong important, acceptable reasons for doing it that outweigh that? Or do you think maybe that the role of unions in the movie industry is different than it was in the mining industry?
Well, the role of, you know, most unions in the movie industry are not unions, they're guilds. And, mm-hmm. and that's a strong confusion, you know, and it's very difficult to operate as a union when you're really a guild. The problem I'm afraid with most Hollywood unions is that they were set up when there were big studios. You came in every day, you worked 50 weeks a year, you had 2 weeks vacation, there was always something shooting on the lot.
And everyone was on salary.
And there weren't really independent people running around making one movie every 3 years on whatever money they could scratch together. So it's a very, very different situation. You know, the unions came about at a time when it was a very stable industry, when in fact it was a monopoly, when the studios owned their own theaters and distributed to their own theaters and knew that they had an outlet. And so there was a lot less risk involved. Now that it's a very risky thing, I'm always willing to say to a bunch of crew people or a union, let's do this as a collective. You know, I'm putting my own money into this thing. I'll put my money and my time in for free if you put your time in for free. And then we'll figure out some kind of hourly, you know, who spent what time on it. And if there's any profit at the end of it, we'll all split it equally, which goes beyond a union. But nobody's interested in doing that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. None of the unions are interested in doing that because it involves risk.
Yeah, and I guess they don't have the kind of personal investment in the movie that you do. I mm-hmm. mean, it's your vision.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in your work as an actor. You've acted in several of your movies, and I think you're a really good actor. I've seen you in I forget the name of the movie, in someone else's movie, too, I saw you.
It was in Hard Choices.
Hard Choices, yeah. But, you know, you always... in your own movies, you always play a character on the margins of the action or a kind of bad guy type.
Uh-huh.
In Leanna, you were this real macho, kind of unlikable guy, but it was very funny the way you played uh-huh. it. You were a kind of enforcer from outer space and the brother from another planet. Mm-hmm. In Mate One, you're a hellfire and brimstone preacher. How come you give yourself those kinds of roles?
Well, I think the marginal part is just because it's hard to direct and act at the same time, mm-hmm. especially if you're doing some kind of character thing. I think the people who are most successful at directing and acting over a period of time are people who basically have a persona, like Buster Keaton or Woody Allen or Clint Eastwood, and very often that's who they're playing in the movie, so that the... You know, they've played that character before. They don't have to do all the work to figure out who the guy is. And also, I imagine they're just better at it than I am. I have a hard time directing and acting at the same time. As far as the bad guy thing, that's just, you know, circumstances. You know, in 8 Men Out, which we're editing now, I play Ring Lardner, who was a famous writer at the time of the Black Sox scandal and was one of the people who covered the series and fairly early on knew about the fix. And he's not a bad guy.
No. How do you act and direct at the same time? I mean, for instance, if you're directing, you can actually watch the action and you'll have mm-hmm. a sense about whether the scene worked or whether you need to do another take. You can't really be watching through peripheral vision while you're acting. That's certainly going to blow your scene.
On the last two movies, I worked with a guy named Steve Apicella who does video assist. And so you attach a video camera to your camera, or a video tap, actually. And so you can tape what you just shot. And so I rarely look at every take. But after I do a bunch, if I feel like I did a good job on one or two of the scenes, I'll go back and everything stops and you go and you look at the videotape. And before that, I just guessed. You know? I just did it until I felt good about it and tried to make sure that any other actors in the scene who were behind me were ones who I felt good about.
Do you have to figure out how to assess your own performance, whether you're being like over egotistical about your performance, if you think that you could have done better in that take, you know, asking everybody to do the scene over again?
Generally, I'll do a couple extra of my own just so that I know I've got it covered, you know. But usually I don't do any more takes than anybody else. I usually feel like I get it fairly quick. You know, I did write the lines, so it's not that difficult for me to learn them. You know, I kind of know the rhythm that I want. So, you know, there's one step that is eliminated, which is that I don't have to tell myself how to play the scene. I already have an idea of how to play the scene,
right.
And I know how the director wants me to do it. And I know how it's
you're on
be,
good terms with him.
Yeah, and I know how it's going to be cut together. So in that way, you know, now and then I'll have a hard time with something because the blocking is difficult or whatever, and I'll have to do it a couple more times. But generally, I can hear it and feel it.
So has Mate One been a breakthrough film for you? It's still playing in a lot of theaters around the country. It got, I think, pretty good reviews and good word of mouth and everything. Has it changed your status in the film world?
No.
And what I mean by that is that you are always, you know, independent filmmaker, lower budget, and this was a big budget for you, modest by everybody else's standards.
Yeah, I don't think your status basically changes unless you have a runaway hit.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a runaway hit, even people who have no idea why it was a runaway hit want to go and kind of touch the magic for a while. And I've never had a runaway hit. I've had a lot of movies that were hits compared to their budgets, but if you only spend $400,000, you don't have to gross that much money to, like, double your profits and all that kind of thing. In fact, you know, I've had movies that were, you know, on our terms, financial successes, which grossed less money than an average, you know, Hollywood movie spends just on advertising. You know, so it's still, you know, kind of a like running a corner bodega compared to running the AMP chain. You know, Mate One's on a bigger scale, but it hasn't become a runaway hit. It's doing good, steady business in a lot of places. And one of the nice things is it's doing its best business in West Virginia, where people really are familiar with the history, and that's makes us feel good because that's one of the things that we really cared about in making the movie. But I don't think it's changed my status.
Well, John Sayles, I want to thank you very much for talking about movies with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been John Sayles. He's a film director, also an actor. The films he's directed include Return of the Secaucus 7, Liana, Baby It's You, Brother from Another Planet, his latest film, Mate One, and his forthcoming film, Eight Men Out. He's also written a new book titled Thinking in Pictures, The Making of the Movie Mate One. And I think I neglected to mention that he's a writer, too, and writes most of the screenplays that he directs. John Sayles joined us from the NPR Bureau in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.